Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
How is my iPhone changing me? I have a subtitle, Neuroscience and Thomistic Psychology. Technology changes us. Electric light bulbs and gas lamps before that, automobiles and gasoline-powered farm equipment, gunpowder and steam locomotion, clocks and the printing press, bronze and iron. These technologies took hold because they helped us achieve what we wanted and created opportunities for new things we didn't know we wanted. In and through that, they also changed our patterns of behavior, our relationships, family dynamics, and economic institutions, the nature of political authority and social status, and our very sense of self. These technologies changed what we wanted, and they changed the we that was wanting. This isn't a new or controversial observation. Plato in the Phaedrus has Socrates remark that the very invention of writing had psychic and social costs. We are used to promoting writing as an essential skill of a well-developed soul, and Plato used it to great effect. But Socrates argues that as a tool for reminding, writing weakened the faculty of remembering, implanting forgetfulness in our souls. He warned that after the advent of writing, people will seem to know much, while for the most part they know nothing. Filled not with wisdom, but with the conceit of wisdom, they will be a burden to their fellows. Digital devices are changing us, especially portable devices and their most popular applications, social media, combining communication with entertainment. This was less well understood several years ago, but now it is common knowledge. The phenomenon invites multiple levels of analysis, as has been addressed from the perspective of political theory, media studies, sociology, childhood development, and more. If you are interested in how digital media influences your sense of your political and bodily agency, I recommend Matthew Crawford's The World Beyond Your Head on becoming an individual in the age of distraction. If you are interested in how digital media has fostered social alienation and isolation, I recommend Sherry Turkle's book Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. For practical advice about how to discipline your use of digital media, try Cal Newport's Deep Work, Rules for Focused Success in a Distracted World. And for neuroscientific analysis of the way the new online ecosystem puts such stress on our old biological hardware, there is The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World by Adam Gazzoli and Larry Rosen. Those are just a few. My approach in this talk is to follow Plato's lead and ask about this technology. What does it change in our soul? What appetites does it feed and what does it starve? What powers does it exercise and which does it allow to atrophy? I want to explore how digital technology is changing our understanding of ourselves, our sense of self-awareness, our interior life, our very experience of agency. And not only in what ways are those changing, but by what mechanisms? Increasingly, we are aware that the personal effects of digital technology are not accidental. That in many ways the devices and the applications they run are designed to change us, engineered specifically to capture and modify our sense of self, how we think, and what we do. The 2020 documentary, The Social Dilemma, is very frank about this. Have any of you seen this documentary? It's on Netflix, 2020 Social Dilemma. It's about social media. Although it addresses various other effects of social media, including political polarization, media manipulation, economic exploitation, depression and anxiety, relationship breakdown, disrupted family dynamics, body image and bullying, all the hot button issues. It gestures towards something deeper. It raises the question of what social media does to the soul. In pursuing this question, I find advantage in the fact that the designers of digital technology have paid particular attention to the closest thing we have to a classical analysis of the powers of the soul, cognitive science, and especially neuroscience. I'm not an expert in these areas, but a little familiarity with classical philosophical psychology gives me an appreciation for the power of neuroscience and also a sense of its limits. Neuroscience helps us understand how digital media is changing us, but we will need other resources to evaluate and protect ourselves from the most ominous of these changes. So the first main part of the talk is called A Brief History of the Digital Experiment. The term smartphone was coined in the 1990s, but the word, and for most people the very idea, didn't become common until the first iPhone was released in 2007. Within 3 years, Apple released the first iPad, the iPhone was well established in world markets, and other web browsing app-based touchscreen pocket computers were competing for market share. 2010 was also the year Nicholas Carr published The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Carr had noticed that spending more time online had changed his habits of attention as a reader and writer, and he turned to neuroscience to explain his experience. The way we interact with the internet, he said, rewires our brains. Web surfing makes us shallow thinkers. Those are quotations. The interruptions, scrolling, clicking all break up attention, challenge our focused awareness, and prevent impressions from penetrating working memory into long-term memory. The abundance of stimuli presents too much cognitive load. The brain adapts, thanks to its neuroplasticity, literally reconfiguring its patterns of activity, making it easier for us to keep scrolling and multitasking, but harder to concentrate, to remember, and to contemplate. Although concerned mainly with the internet in general, rather than specifically with portable devices, Carr described phenomena that the advent of the smartphone greatly accelerated. Carr's attention to the neurological effects of online life is well complemented by a reflection 7 years ago from Andrew Sullivan when he checked himself into rehab for digital addiction. The 7,000-word essay he published about that experience, what led him there, how close he was to breaking down, and what it was like to suffer withdrawal, foregrounds the spiritual dimensions of what he saw as at stake. The original print title was My Distraction Sickness and Yours. Online, it was called I Used to Be a Human Being. It describes more than his personal experience, but a new epidemic of distraction, which is our civilization's specific weakness. And the problem, he says, is spiritual. As Sullivan put it, the threat is not so much to our minds, even as they shape-shift under the pressure. The threat is to our souls. At this rate, he continues, if the noise does not relent, we might even forget that we have any. Sullivan aptly draws on religious resources to make sense of this challenge. The Judeo-Christian tradition, he says, recognized a critical distinction and tension between noise and silence, between getting through the day and getting a grip on one's whole life. The Sabbath, the Jewish institution co-opted by Christianity, was a collective imposition of relative silence, a moment of calm to reflect on our lives under the light of eternity. According to Sullivan, the loss of a cultural habit of Sabbath changes us. It slowly removes, he says, without our even noticing it, the very spaces where we can gain a footing in our minds and souls that is not captive to constant pressures or desires or duties. And the smartphone has all but banished them. I want to try to bridge the gap between these two discourses, brains and souls, the neuroscientific objectivity of Carr and the spiritual interiority of Sullivan. I believe philosophical approaches to the soul help to bridge that gap. But first, it will help for us to attend to an attempt to bridge it technologically, the project of artificial intelligence. The advances in computer processing that have made portable digital devices possible have also enabled the collection and analysis and use of data on a scale and in a manner never before imagined. As advances in artificial intelligence increasingly inform the design of digital technology, it is not only the case that digital media devices happen to change us, but more than any other previous technology, they are designed to change us. So this next section is called Admitting We Have a Problem. We know that social media isn't really free. We aren't the customer, but the product. That is to say, by using social media, we are voluntarily providing information about ourselves. And that information is valuable. A common misunderstanding is that social media companies collect data to sell it, leading many to assume that the problems we face relate primarily to privacy and economic exploitation. In fact, however, social media companies don't exactly sell the data they collect. It is too valuable to sell. As conveyed in the documentary, The Social Dilemma, the collected data holds the key to change your behavior. In the words of Jaron Lanier, who helped design artificial intelligence but now warns of its dangers, the goal is changing what you do, what you think, who you are. Tim Kendall, former director of monetization at Facebook, says the question driving digital media companies is, how much of your life can we get you to give to us? Social media wants you, without any regard for your own good. Google's former design ethicist, Tristan Harris, now executive director for the Center for Humane Technology, explains, social media isn't a tool that's just waiting to be used. It has its own goals, and it has its own means of pursuing them by using your psychology against you. Even from a purely economic perspective, the industry exploits its users. The business model has been called surveillance capitalism, in which profit comes from the promise of a kind of psychological custody. Every major smartphone app, especially social media, is the interface for an artificial intelligence algorithm which constantly processes everything it learns about you, updating a virtual representation of you, testing hypotheses about it against your real behavior, and continuing to update the model. The goal is not merely to predict your patterns of behavior, but by presenting you with customized digital stimuli, to actually shape what you do. Through its app, a social media company doesn't serve people, but makes markets in them. What is commodified is not information from and about you, but your very attention and behavior. In market terms, Shoshana Zuboff of the Harvard Business School calls it trading in human futures. It is thus not merely your data that these companies try to harvest, but your mind and your will. In the documentary, Lanier clarifies the product of social media is not information or even attention, but the gradual, slight, imperceptible change in your own behavior and perception. Harris uses more directly moral terms. It's seducing you. It's manipulating you. It wants things from you. Manipulation, seduction, it wants things from you. Do you hear the language of temptation, of spiritual danger? These tech leaders have seen it. They participated in it. They engineered it, and they profited from it. Yet they have also protected their children from it, and they are naturally horrified by it. They apparently feel guilt and even seek absolution through activism and a new evangelization of responsible reform. This next part is called weaponized neuroscience. If unaccountable powers are using weaponized neuroscience in the form of AI algorithms to manipulate us, maybe there should be some oversight. Some of the participants in the Social Dilemma advocate greater government regulation of tech companies. And in 2021, a Facebook employee drew headlines by blowing the whistle on the social media company for not taking seriously enough its political influence. If the algorithms are manipulating us, maybe we need to fortify democracy and appeal to a power strong enough to make sure that we are manipulated in the right way. Alternatively, maybe we could design the algorithms better or contrive a new algorithm to protect us. Thrive Global is a company that helps organizations create a behavior change ecosystem. We've cracked the code on behavior change. Its website touts its behavior change platform, which promises a holistic approach to increasing your people's well-being and resilience. The Thrive app uses artificial intelligence to develop the whole human, supporting your people's physical, mental, and emotional well-being in one comprehensive platform. The CEO on Thrive says that it helps shift the way businesses use technology to create personalized, empathetic employee experiences. Thrive's holistic behavior modification app was enabled by the purchase in 2019 of a company called Boundless Mind, a neuroscience-based artificial intelligence company offering an AI platform for behavior design. I'm using its own language. Website copy from 2018 bragged about building engagement and retention and helping app usage to become a user's habit. Habits, it says, are programmable. Boundless AI optimizes when and how to praise and encourage each user uniquely. Boundless Mind was itself a strategic 2017 rebrand of a company originally founded in 2014 as Dopamine Labs. Its website was unapologetic about the drug addiction metaphor. UseDopamine.com announced, "Keeping users engaged isn't luck, it's science. Give users the right hit of dopamine at the right moment and they'll stay longer, do more, and monetize better." Co-founder Randy Brown says, "We crafted for it to learn something about the structure of how human motivation works. It is now gathering enough data on its own to make meaningful observations to change human behavior." Their homepage announced it was building the future of web-scale mind control. Notice the progression from get them hooked and brain hacking and mind control to behavior design and behavior engineering, and then to behavior change for holistic well-being. Rebranded from engineering addiction to cultivating virtue, the packaging has changed, and perhaps even the intention, but the method and the mechanism are the same. Artificial intelligence does not so much fortify the self against manipulation, but only submit it to a more comprehensive and perhaps benevolent version. It is understandable that we would respond to the dangers of technology by seeking better oversight or more humane design. But if that is all we do, we are only accepting the technocratic paradigm that gave rise to our concerns, a paradigm that sees people as means, not ends, that doesn't take responsibility for action, that doesn't care about truth. A technocrat only focuses on the effectiveness of a means to a given end, with no wonder about what the end should be. That may well describe the operation of artificial intelligence, but it can't be the attitude of intelligent human beings who want to know how to evaluate and resist the influence of behavior modification algorithms. So now, neuroscience and the soul. One aspect that the social dilemma documentary manages to convey is the spiritual stakes of this technocratic nightmare. A clever artistic choice to make the film more dramatic than a series of talking heads centers around an imaginative personification of the algorithm. On screen, the complex artificial intelligence that constantly monitors and responds to a user's social media behavior is depicted by three figures. Each represents essential initiatives at social media companies: engagement, advertising, and growth. Scheming and conspiring to attract, hold, and deploy a user's attention, they are cold and manipulative, but they are not impersonal. Indeed, they are each skillfully played by the same actor, as if displaying the interior dialogue of a powerful being. The filmmaker's dramatic sensibility makes it plain. The threat is spiritual. The algorithm wants to steal your soul. Let me put it another way. The algorithm is functionally demonic. What it achieves through digital processing is exactly what C.S. Lewis depicts the fallen angels doing in his famous portrayal of temptation, The Screwtape Letters. They analyze your psyche in order to manipulate it. Lewis's book consists of fictional letters from Master Tempter Screwtape advising his nephew and apprentice Wormwood. Most of Screwtape's lessons are about particular modes of temptation, which work by corrupting common and natural desires, say for food and friendship, sex and marriage, status and security, knowledge and political engagement. But right up front, Screwtape describes to Wormwood, and so to us, the basic what and how of leading people into sin. It is not by proposing devil worship. It is not even by directly planting thoughts and intentions. Demons don't teach. They mislead and confuse. They color our perceptions. They lead our attention astray. Their dominant work is distraction. Screwtape explains the function of demons in language that could describe the efforts of the AI algorithms. Your business, he says, is to fix his attention on the stream of immediate sense experience. To us, a human is primarily food. Our aim is the absorption of its will into ours. the increase of our area of selfhood at its expense. Lewis's demons, like the algorithm, don't have direct access to our will and intellect, but they can infer things about them and move them indirectly through an uncanny ability to monitor our physical activity, our heartbeats, our eye movements, our expressions. They see all our behavior, even the subtlest and most imperceptible physiological changes, and from these can infer our fears, our desires, our intentions, and thoughts. That is all they need to get our attention, to place temptations before us, to frame our decisions, and so to modify our behavior. Lewis meant to scare us, but he also meant to encourage. His story of temptation is not a horror story. It is clever and very comic. Indirectly, through Screwtape's letters, we learn about how to strengthen ourselves against the tempter's art. We can learn from this, for while the technology of digital temptation may be new, the means of protecting ourselves is old. Before getting to this advice, however, let us consider a crucial assumption. I suspect that how threatening you find the algorithm depends to some degree on how you think human consciousness is related to our biology. For if you think human agency and awareness is entirely a function of and dependent on physical processes, it would be very scary indeed to realize just how much power modern technology can and will exercise over your body. It implies the possibility of not merely technological temptation and manipulation, but of technological oppression and possession. That agency and awareness are functions of physical processes is a common assumption, but not a necessary assumption, of modern neuroscience. The project of neuroscience proceeds with the working hypothesis that by understanding the operations of physical physiological systems, we will be able to explain the cognitive life of human beings. And this hypothesis goes way back. Plato, in the Phaedo, puts an argument in the mouth of Simmias that our life, or psyche, or soul, is a function of the physical activity of our parts. To communicate this, he strikes on a charming metaphor. The soul, Simmias says, is like the harmony of an instrument. It is an attractive hypothesis, for it seems to account for features of the life power that we regard as mysterious. Like music coming from an instrument, the soul is invisible. It is valuable. It can't exactly be reduced to physical structure, nor located in one part or another of the physical instrument. And yet, one can kill a harmony by physically damaging the instrument. The soul as harmony, as a function of physical activity, fits with all of this. In the Phaedo, Socrates quickly demolishes the theory. A harmony has no power to direct or rule the instrument. The instrument directs or rules the harmony. Socrates does not deny that the soul is affected by the body, nor that we can learn about the soul's powers by studying the body. But in large part, due to its ruling or providence over the body, the soul is even more marvelous than a musical harmony. There is much to wonder about here, and we could say, to modify a phrase from Plato and Aristotle describing philosophy, that neuroscience begins with this wonder. How are particular life functions related to bodily activity? This key question also motivated Aristotle's inquiry into the soul, and he proceeded to differentiate various life powers, the different things a living organism does to move and grow and negotiate its environment. To understand human life, we especially need to differentiate various cognitive powers or modes of awareness, some, but not all of which, we share with other animals. We tend to think of consciousness or intelligence as one thing, but the mystery of it is that it draws on and unifies so many different things. Sensing, feeling, imagining, evaluating, judging, anticipating, wishing, guessing, remembering, calculating, intending, deliberating, wondering, contemplating. And some of those we seem to have more control over than others, more responsibility to direct or exercise. Neuroscience imagines each of these as a function of something physical in our bodies, and so in principle detectable and even replicable. For hundreds of years, we didn't have tools like electromagnetic resonance imaging or x-rays or even sophisticated surgery to detect this activity, nor did we even have the theoretical models like chemistry or atomic and electromagnetic theories that have made modern neuroscience what it is, nor did we have the ability to try to build replicas or simulations of such activities, And in fact, all of these arise and advance together. But something like the neuroscientific aspiration to discover and explain the inner bodily workings of cognitive experience did evolve even without the assumption that all cognitive experience is a function of bodily activity. Neuroscience didn't begin with materialism. It began with wonder, and it proceeds, as did Plato's Simmias, through metaphors. As Plato's Phaedo showed, the key question of neuroscience has always been, to what shall we analogize the soul's activity? Empirical study of the mechanisms of life function does not require the Simmias hypothesis, that the soul is a harmony, but it seems to draw energy from having some metaphor or other. We can see the development of neuroscience as grasping for ever more advanced and complicated metaphors for how the wondrous activity of mind could be connected to bodily activity. Some ancient thinkers thought of the body as a series of pumps and vessels. Descartes thought of the body as a machine. Indeed, he took the metaphor so literally that life and consciousness was, in principle for him, separable from it. He regarded consciousness and embodiedness as so different that the one could be imagined totally without the other. I may be dreaming, and the I that is dreaming may be only an immaterial being, like an angel. The discovery of electricity gave a new set of metaphors, the soul as charges moving through circuits. And the invention of computers gave us even more elaborate metaphors. Indeed, computer technology is so fascinating that we started by comparing its functions to human ones, storage as memory and processing as decisions. But now that the computer is more familiar and comprehensible to us than the mysterious brain, it has become the root of the metaphor for human processing and retrieval. And many have imagined that human consciousness is itself software that it could, at least in principle, be uploaded to run on another platform. The technological details have changed, but we are still not far from Simmias' metaphor of a musical instrument's harmony. Increasingly, however, neuroscientists themselves are facing the fact that the mechanistic models are inadequate, and that even trying to isolate the brain from the rest of the body may itself be as much a mistake as Descartes isolating the pineal gland from the rest of the brain. It seems we think with our whole bodies. An important branch of neuroscience explores the cognitive significance of our intestinal tract, and the irreducibility of organic life is increasingly acknowledged. Not only can we treat the brain almost as an organism in its own right, we can treat it as a collection of organisms. Empirical research itself is running up against the limits of the brain as computer model. Both the complexity of the brain and evolutionary accounts of its development lead us to think of it not merely as an instrument or organ, but as an organism, or even as a collection of organisms in a kind of mysterious parliament. With his thousand brains hypothesis, Jeff Hawkins imagines the brain as a kind of socio-political entity with collections of structures lobbying and building consensus, voting and vetoing. Neuroscience often learns from and contributes to the field of artificial intelligence, attempts to produce or simulate or replicate these living functions in machines. Along the way, both neuroscience and artificial intelligence find greater need to attend to psychology and philosophy in the form of theoretical neuroscience or cognitive science or cognitive psychology. In other words, the very empirical study of animal life functions cannot leave behind the original Aristotelian reflection on the different kinds of consciousness or cognition. Whatever metaphor hypothesis neuroscientists work with informs their research into the brain, and it also suggests the best hopes for replicating the brain's work by artificial means. So maybe your consciousness is not a harmony, a pump, a network of gears and levers, a collection of circuits, nor even an already written software program. Maybe instead it is a complex self-learning algorithm, a large language learning model rewriting itself in iterative feedback loops of parallel processing, maybe. Yet there remain some pesky functions, used especially in pursuing empirical science, which are not captured in even our most advanced metaphors or models. Human memory is not mere retrieval, but an act of conjuring, inherently creative and akin to imagination. Deciding is not simply running a subroutine, but an exercise of agency, of will. An abstract thought is more than processing information, but understanding concepts and affirming truth. Comprehending realities that transcend whatever physical means may encode or communicate them. Even the recent success of language-generating bots, as stunning an accomplishment as they are, has drawn equal attention to the limits, the literal non-intelligence of merely processing signs without comprehending what is signified, that is, without experiencing signs as signifying. To the extent that any algorithm played out only in and through physical activity, to the extent that any algorithm is only played out in and through physical activity, it is no more like a rational soul than is a musical harmony. And the same is true of any metaphor or model that would reduce living and thinking to motion in a machine. If Plato and Aristotle are right, we won't be able to build a brain, only to simulate it, and really only to simulate some of its cognitive functions, without the ones that most make us human. We're near the end. This next section is called Spiritual Armor and Weapons. I earlier compared social media's psychic insinuation to demonic manipulation. The comparison did not imply devious intention, but it was meant as a realistic assessment of our predicament, which could point us towards help. C.S. Lewis was drawing on a very old confidence in the spiritual resources by which human beings can resist the pervasive temptations now mechanized and monetized by digital technology. In creating his demonic characters, Lewis seems to have drawn on St. Thomas Aquinas' analysis of angelic powers in his Summa Theologiae. Aquinas takes up the puzzle of how purely spiritual beings could interact with, much less influence, the embodied rational animal, and he draws on Aristotle's distinctions of our cognitive functions and how and whether they are related to bodily activity. Strictly speaking, our will and intellect transcend the body. They are immaterial powers that can only be known directly by God. But even observant human beings can sometimes discern your secret thoughts and intentions through their effects, subtle muscle movements, the direction of a glance, the quickening of a pulse, the drain of blood from your face. Angels, fallen and otherwise, can do this even better than any human being or analytic tool. And while they can thus guess at our thoughts and intentions, which remain subject to our will, they have more immediate access to our imaginations and desires as embedded in our bodily nature. So they can't control our will and intellect, but they can tempt us through our feelings and our perceptions. Temptation is not puppetry. Spiritual creatures can't directly move our wills, but they can sway us in the manner of an orator, anticipating our preconceptions or provoking our passions. Temptation doesn't control choice, but it modifies what we perceive as choice-worthy. Arousing passions of anger and craving, tempting spirits can make it easier for us to consent to what we otherwise would not. So demons stimulate our behaviors through a craft akin to rhetoric. The devil, Aquinas reminds us, is called the kindler of thoughts, inasmuch as he incites to thought by the desires of the things thought of, by way of persuasion, by rousing the passions. Demons assault us then by the same mechanism and for the same reason as the ever-adapting and insidious algorithm, in order to explore this inward disposition of man, to discern susceptibility to habits, and then by manipulating attention to develop those habits. This sober realization, paradoxically, is, I think, a source of hope. Neither spiritual demons nor digital algorithms can directly violate our intellect and will. They seek them, but can never possess them without our consent. The defense against the new dark arts of Silicon Valley thus relies on the same tools as ancient spiritual warfare, especially custody of our attention. Of course, demons attack our weaknesses. Virtues have been called the spiritual armor protecting us from assault, and it is vice that makes us vulnerable. But even here, demons need opportunity to attack. Advising Wormwood on effective methods of temptation, Screwtape warns against letting his target engage in basic exercises of will and reason. Going for a walk, reading a book, even asking questions, these are all powerful human defenses against the distractions of the devil. Individual acts of thinking and choosing for oneself, exercising self-awareness and taking responsibility for one's actions and thoughts, the distinctive activities of the rational animal, are themselves safeguards against the soul snatcher's designs. I hope attending a philosophy lecture can be an occasion for soul strengthening too. Listening and interpreting require a disciplined focus of attention, contemplating, wondering, asking why. All of these intentional human acts are, in the face of temptation, subversive and protective. Perhaps this can also give us new appreciation for the power of prayer, sometimes described as a spiritual weapon. More than any other deliberate activity, prayer activates and directs the soul's various modes of cognition, ordering them to deeper understanding of self and union with God. Think of the four phases of traditional Lectio Divina, reading, meditation, prayer, and contemplation, each focusing and directing in different ways the intellect and will and ordering them to God, first receiving and interpreting words, then considering their meaning and application, then addressing God in specific intentions, and finally lovingly receiving God's presence. Or consider the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola, a classic handbook for retreat. The standard cycles of prayer repeat three steps, each demanding discipline over one's attention. First, composition, exercising imagination and memory, recalling sins, visualizing oneself in the presence of other people, even imagining particular sensations of smell, touch, and hearing, all to be more aware of one's soul and put oneself in the presence of God. Second, analysis, activating the intellect, conceiving, understanding, and assenting to truths, reasoning about their implications and connections, and contemplating them. And third, colloquy, reflecting on choices and principles of choice, resolving to make good decisions, and especially exerting the will in acts of humility and love. This method of prayer exercises the traditional Trinitarian powers of the soul, memory, intellect, and will, three powers that, incidentally, the algorithm wants but cannot access without our cooperation, and three powers that the most advanced artificial intelligence will prove incapable of simulating. At a very basic level, by simply taking custody of our minds, by directing our attention, taking responsibility for what we give our cognitive energy to, we experience the mysterious agency that Simmias's harmony theory could not account for, and we discipline the very power that digital media is so eager to distract and consume. The powers that neuroscience thus finds most elusive are the powers that can protect us from that assault. As it has ever been, the central challenge of spiritual discipline is, are we choosing where to give our attention? Attention is the inner energy of the soul, and when it is sucked away and diverted, the soul falls into acedia, spiritual sloth, a failure of the will to act. And the path to the deadly apathy of acedia is its daughter vice of curiositas, which we may call a cognitive intemperance, discharging the energy of the soul's attention without the discipline of intention. Digital technology depends on and fosters and exploits this cognitive intemperance. This is why so many of the books mentioned at the beginning address the problem of distraction. In our natural environment, we have plenty of things to distract us, but also plenty to remind us where we must give our attention and move us to action. What is unprecedented about the environment of social media is that it offers a potentially limitless field of personalized distraction. The age of digital media has unleashed a profoundly threatening human experiment. By drawing us to waste not only our time, but our attention, social media seduces us to waste our souls. Our brightest engineers have trained our most powerful technology to act with the psychological craftiness of demons. But like the hapless targets of Screwtape and Wormwood, we can begin to protect ourselves from the tempting distractions of technology by asking about it and recognizing it for what it is, by wondering about our nature and remembering who we are. We can go for a walk or read a book. We can philosophize and pray. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.